Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's editor. The story we feature this month is by professional archaeologist Dana Cameron, who makes use of her knowledge of culture and history to write mysteries, and has turned out half a dozen critically acclaimed novels, as well as many award-winning short stories. The series to which this tale belongs has brought the author nominations for nearly all of our genre's major awards. Here is the Massachusetts author reading her story, Disarming. Set in pre-Revolutionary War New England and England, it's from the June 2011 EQMM.
Disarming by Dana Cameron. It took Anna Hoyt 2 days before she left her small room at the Southwark Inn. She had not been ill a single day during her voyage, despite the late season and the roughness seas, while some passengers never left their cabins. Nor was it the distressing contents of the letter she kept in her Bible that paralyzed her. It was the sheer size of London looming beyond her window, shrouded by icy fog. Even her life near the Boston Wharves hadn't prepared her for the tumult she encountered by the waterfront, slippery with briny mud. She was nearly run down twice before she found a carter willing to take her and her luggage. The driver incomprehensibly cursed her when she asked him a third time to repeat his price. At length she understood he was speaking English, but with the thickest Welsh accent she had ever heard. He urged his horses into the gloom, muttering to himself as Anna clung to her seat, miserable and shivering in the frigid January rain. That last mile on land had robbed her nerve. Once in her room, Anna locked the door behind her and sat trembling on the bed. Feeling small and alone, she huddled there, not venturing even as far as the tray of food the landlord had left on the table. It seemed too distant, too dangerous to cross the floor from the square yard of bed she claimed as her own. After some time alone, however, she was propelled not only by boredom, but the pressing knowledge that she did not travel on her own behalf. That letter, with its red wax seal, along with drafts for a small fortune, served to remind her. While Anna had never known good news to come in a letter, it was possible this terrible threat mingled with opportunity. 2 months earlier, November 1745, she had been summoned to the country house of Mr. Oliver Brown by his agent, Adam Seaver. When he brought the request, Seaver had smiled, and Anna had barely contained her shudder. Seaver's teeth were like his personality, broken and unlovely, but he made a good enough figure when he tried. He always tried with Anna, and she was grateful. His reputation as a dangerous man was no rumor. She could not imagine why his employer, the monstrously powerful Mr. Brown, wanted to see her, or why he did not come to her tavern. Stomach churning, Anna waited for the carriage Brown had promised. As she departed the Queen's Arms, Venus stepping from a seashell, her finery a shock of loveliness against the rough wooden exterior, she considered flight. She did not like leaving the boisterous North End, where everyone knew her. Stiff in her new dress and her pretend calm, Anna rode as if to her own trial. A few miles outside Boston, in the countryside of Medford, she viewed Brown's home. 2.5 stories of pleasing brick symmetry with 5 bays of glass windows overlooking gardens, orchards, and fields. Her confidence rose as she descended from the carriage. She was gratified by the size and splendor of the house. Her ledger foretold a favorable future, and as an honest woman of business, she could meet Brown almost as an equal if she could not meet him without fear. This confidence grew as Brown, a well-fed and well-dressed little man, welcomed her to a parlor furnished with relics from earlier generations, perhaps even his own family's goods. Silver plate and chinaware in blue and white gleamed from an ancient cupboard. The walls were well-plastered and painted and hung with stern portraits. Seated at a table covered with an immaculate white cloth, Anna sighed with a kind of contentment. Perhaps there was nothing to fear. Perhaps all would be well. "I am delighted to meet you, Mistress Hoyt." Brown eased himself into a fashionable chair, too dainty to comfortably accommodate him. He poured wine. "Do you know London, I wonder?" As she took the proffered glass, Anna started. The garnet wine met the edge of her glass but did not spill over. Of all the topics she might have expected, her recent widowhood, and the disappearance of a local tough, London was the last on the list. London might as well have been the moon. She examined her glass as if admiring it. "I have never been, sir." "I would like to send you there." Her astonishment could not have been greater. She looked up. "Why, Mr. Brown?" "I think you can be of use to me, if you would. A voyage would help distract you from the grief of your husband's murder." "My husband met with accident, drunk on the wharf," she said as if by rote. He paid no notice. "And distract you also from feelings that must surely follow the perplexing disappearance of Hook Miller." She felt her jaw tighten. "What's Miller to do with me? He wanted to buy my tavern, and I refused." "Hook Miller is gone," she thought. "I managed Hook Miller." "Indeed," Brown continued, "he was last seen leaving for your place, and never seen after." She shrugged, her heart racing now. Never seen again, save by my man here. He nodded to Seaver. Who watched you haul Hook's carcass to your kitchen to carve him up? For bait, I hope. Anna said nothing, couldn't have if she wanted. She noticed her hand shaking and pressed the glass to her lips to conceal it. Seaver watched her from behind Brown's chair. She drank anyway. The wine seemed wholesome and tasted of honey. With these tragedies so hard on the heels of your father's illness and death, I would like to help you, Brown said, leaning forward. If you were not to go, I would turn aside, should you ever find yourself in need, for whatever reason. I've survived much without you knowing my name. Why me? She jerked her head at Seaver, when you have so many already at your command. I could send Seaver, but he's known in London. Brown grimaced, and look at him. He refuses to wear the perfectly good teeth I bought for him. No, a workman needs a variety of tools, each suited to its particular job. Brown tapped his fingers. Obviously, I can compel you by virtue of my knowledge, but how much more interesting that you kept your appointment today. You remain calm, even now. And you were curious. Anna could barely breathe. You make vile hints and threats. Why should I trust you? Do or do not, he said. Decide quickly, though, for speed is of the utmost importance. The ship I mean you to sail on leaves next week. His presumption was too much. The room closed in around Anna. Her late husband, however, had taught her well the virtues of concealing emotion and speaking cautiously. Mr. Brown, why should I go to London for you? For no reason but to oblige me, and to gain my friendship. Think carefully, Mistress Hoyt. The idea that he believed he could command her so easily, turn her from her business to his own with so little care, blindsided Anna. A black rage threatened to swallow her up. He sets the tune and I must dance because he has the power to reveal so much. She moved her eyes from the small knife Brown had used to open the wine to the bottle itself, marked with his own seal and filled, no doubt, from private barrels in his cellar. A silver teapot and its attendant service caught her eye on another table covered with a turkey-work rug. With a jolt, Anna realized her beloved home was dark and crude in comparison. After all she'd done to protect it, the security of her tavern was an illusion. Brown's goodwill was not to be dismissed lightly, she thought. Rumors that his fortune arose from piracy, slavery, and smuggling, that judges were swayed by his presence in court, that politicians cast nervous glances his way before voting, were rampant. He might keep the law and the local rascals away from me, this favor for him done. He might even leave me alone. She took another sip of wine and raised her eyes to Brown, surprised to find her face still in softly pleasant lines. Perhaps I shall go. I am very glad of it. What is my errand? He paused delicately. I have a rival in affairs, Mr. Edward Earle. He won't be reasoned with, and his actions threaten to ruin me. His heir will not be such an impediment to my business. Anna's brow creased. This was entirely beyond her. And how do you think I might remove him? I merely want you to make his acquaintance, learn his vulnerabilities. Nothing more? Brown showed the edge of an impatient ill temper. Find a way to meet him, observe him, report to me how I might use his weaknesses against him. Only it must be soon. The bill that interests us both goes before Parliament in the spring, and I yet lack his influence there. You have 3 weeks after you arrive to leave a report with the captain of my ship, Indomitable. A curious request, she thought, when he must have servants better equipped to observe Earl. She was happy enough to meet this price, though. I, alas, cannot leave. She looked around the room. My business requires constant attention, or I starve. He smiled and gestured to Seaver, who handed him several pieces of paper, a sealed letter, and a purse. If you have one you trust to watch your establishment for a few months, I will supply all you need. More. When she returned home, Brown's purse was heavy in the pocket under her skirt, his papers tucked into her shoes. Anna surveyed the common room of the Queen's Arms, gave instructions to the barmaid, and retired to her chamber. She sat down at her desk and began to study her Bible. Each day for the next week after she arrived, Anna set herself a new destination to overcome her intimidation. The scale of London was like nothing she could have imagined, teeming and stinking, with 700,000 souls. The bad roads, clogged with every kind of traffic, made travel by foot perilous. Once she hired a sedan, which was jostling and expensive, but most often she paid one of the astonishingly coarse watermen to ferry her across the rank river and walked from there. The sheer noise of so many people acquiring the means for life and the support of an empire was daunting. Each neighborhood was like a little village. This one was more fashionable, the next devoted to business and craftsmen, this one to the law, and so on. She marveled at the grandness of St. Paul's Cathedral, and when she viewed the Tower Menagerie and the other merrymakers baiting the great lions with dogs, she noted how Londoners loved a good brawl. She learned which coffee houses were frequented by artists, merchants, and foreigners, and which taverns were the best for news. As she became familiar with the city, Anna began to observe the more elevated society, its modes and manners, the people most likely to have access to Earl. During the week spent crossing the Atlantic, she'd made herself frantic with one question. How did one meet Edward Earl? She made inquiries, and after learning the names of the best inns, moved to one on the north side of the Thames, in the western end of London, without giving up her rooms near the Great Stone Bridge in Southwark. Installed at this finer inn, she learned where to go to scrutinize the gentlemen and ladies of the higher ranks. She knew she could not penetrate Earl's circle from above, but not from too far below, either. She was a little disappointed to discover she was as comfortably anonymous in her dress, neither too rich nor too shabby, as any local lady of means. Boston was not so far behind London then, but a pretty gown was not enough. From time to time, Anna had the distinct sensation of being observed, stalked. Her skin crawled whenever it happened, and she would hurry back to her room. Each night she pored over newspapers. She scanned them for word of Earl or his associates, and found he was very much a public gentleman, devoted to pleasure as well as his business. Just before bed, she also reread the red wax sealed letter given to her by Mr. Brown, the copy of another in her possession. Mr. Justice Harcourt, you must inquire with Mistress Anna Hoyt of the Queen's Arms about the murder of Robert Miller, called Hook. One day, when asked by a young man, Anna was gratified to be able to give directions. Knowing the place was where travelers with business gathered to exchange news, she impulsively said, "Perhaps you would see me there." She touched his arm and watched him color. "I believe I almost recognize your voice, for are you not also from New England?" "New York, madam. It would be my pleasure to escort you." He made a decent leg, then offered her his arm. "Faith, it is good to hear familiar accents. London is a filthy maze and a veritable Babel." She smiled kindly. "You prefer the countryside, perhaps?" "I am sick for the sight of homely places and friendly faces. When my ship leaves, I shall be thankful." This reminded Anna of the Indomitable, its departure date 2 weeks hence, her letter about Earl still unwritten. She banished the thought. "We are here," she announced. "Thank you, madam. I never fail to lose myself in this warren." He offered her coffee, then introduced her to his friends, all American merchants. Soon Anna was the center of attention. It was no different from her fishermen and sailors. She fixed the pleasant look over her boredom and let them show off for her with their talk of business and politics. She almost fell asleep, smothered by the smoke of their interminable pipes, but revived when they mentioned names she recognized, men close to Earl. Finally, encouraged by the enlivening coffee, one of them asked her her purpose in London. Taking her cue from their stories, Anna instantly fabricated a husband with a claim against Mr. Earl, and how she, now a widow, sought the money for herself. "I wish I had better news for you, Mrs. Hoyt," said a reed-thin gentleman. "Mr. Earl has been the source of all my hope, and lately, all my discouragement. He has avoided my calls to his home and ignored my letters. An acquaintance of mine arranged an introduction once. Nicholas suffered for that kindness to me, I fear. Mr. Earl is not only hard in business, but very cruel to those who displease him." He took a deep sip. "I was very rudely received, and planned to return home next week, for London has eaten my funds." Anna said, "Perhaps you would introduce me to this friend. I would be happy for any advantage in my endeavor." He glanced at her. "I am certain Nicholas would be delighted to meet you," he said. After Anna left, she wandered very late, thinking. Suddenly, she felt herself shoved into an alley. A second man pulled her in deeper and slammed her head against the stone wall. "Money," he said. "Now." Outraged, she slapped her attacker. She would not suffer his abuse. Then the first man appeared next to his fellow, and she knew she was doomed. A knife bit into her shoulder. Anna screamed. One of the thieves vanished, and she heard the sounds of fighting deeper in the alley. The man with the knife jerked back, and she was free. A stink of rotting teeth, then a familiar voice said, "Run, woman." Anna ran. Within sight of her inn, she slowed, her breathing constrained by the boning in her bodice. It had been Seaver who rescued her. Anna knew now she was being tested. If she failed in her errand, she would be killed as surely as Seaver was killing the two cut purses. That evening, Anna counted the money drawn against Mr. Brown's letters of credit. She studied the papers for boats leaving England. She considered her options, fleeing with the money to abandon her home, or obeying Brown. And she turned to her Bible. It fell open to St. Luke. She read what one must render unto Caesar and unto God. The next morning, Anna arose later than usual. After she examined her shoulder, the wound was painful but shallow, she went downstairs and was greeted by the innkeeper. "Ah, here's another of our foreign ladies." Before Anna could correct him, she was an Englishwoman, he asked, "Will you break your fast with Mrs. Western?" "Sit with me and never mind him," that lady called. Anna recognized the woman's Bristol accent from the sailors who frequented the Queen's Arms. Londoners are insufferable. Mrs. Western was the particular friend of Mr. Upton, a gentleman who spent most of his time in London. Anna tried to conceal her excitement as the woman prattled on. Mr. Upton was a close acquaintance of Edward Earle. Mrs. Weston was delighted to gossip and to show herself in every way Anna's superior, so Anna sifted each grain of useful information from a very great deal of chaff. She forced herself to be patient and not think of Brown's commands nor Seaver's presence. "I understand Mr. Upton to be a close friend of Mr. Edward Earle," she said. "What is that gentleman like?"
"Well, he's very handsome, very rich." Mrs. Weston studied her chicken stew intently.
"Isn't handsome and rich good enough?"
"You'd hope so, wouldn't you?" After looking around, she leaned in, lowered her voice. "It's not enough for him to get what he wants. He's not happy until he's taken away someone else's happiness." Anna also whispered, her interest completely genuine, "Mr. Earle sounds very wicked."
"Perhaps he's also generous enough with his acquaintances."
"Ladies, I mean." She regarded Anna with a sisterly eye. "You are interested." Anna decided the truth would serve.
"I seem to collect scoundrels."
Mrs. Weston was thrilled at the chance to enlarge herself in Anna's eyes. "Edward, Mr. Earle, I mean, hosts a gathering a week hence. Join us, why don't you?"
"How very kind. Thank you."
The landlord's boy coughed quietly then and handed Anna a note. She read it, folded it, and put it away.
"He'll meet you in the small parlor," the boy said.
Anna nodded.
Mrs. Weston said, "Notes and meetings in private, at breakfast."
The woman's words were painfully arch, and Anna straightened herself.
"I have business with this gentleman. I do not discuss business in public."
Mrs. Weston shrunk at this, and Anna realized she'd scared the woman. She'd never known herself to be intimidating, and found this information useful.
Mrs. Weston said stiffly, "I meant no harm."
"None was taken. I merely wish to be clear. A lady's reputation is all she has."
Mrs. Weston looked away. "Certainly."
The gentleman in the parlor, so marked by his elegant shoes and in his excellent deportment, had not taken off his hat or cloak. His face was largely concealed by a scarf, still damp from the outside. Anna saw gray eyes that were quick yet wary.
"Mr. Nicholas?" She made her courtesy, and he his. He still did not remove his wet cloak.
"I understand you have business with Mr. Earle," he said, his words somewhat muffled by a scarf. "I would dissuade you if I could. No suit you bring would be worth it, and the only reason he might entertain it would be to indulge his more destructive appetites." Anna folded her hands. "You have a distaste for the gentleman." A barking laugh came from inside the scarf. "I would see him in hell if I could." His enmity toward Earle was genuine, Anna was certain. Emboldened by this frankness, she asked, "And if I said I had no interest in meeting him, but to discover how to ruin him?" The gray eyes appraised her. After a moment, he said, "Call the boy and order tea." He shrugged off his cloak and unwound his scarf. Her business with Mr. Nicholas concluded, Anna found her way to a tailor, he suggested. The tailor was examining his account books, and Anna felt a stab of homesickness. As she paused to examine a mannequin dressed in a miniature of the latest fashion, Anna understood the man was nearly drunk. She said, "I need to insinuate myself into a discerning circle, a party, at the home of Mr. Edward Earle." "Would that Mr. Earle was as prompt with his payment as he is with his newest orders," he said, closing his ledger. "Liberal beyond belief with his friends, he makes me wait for my money until it's almost a shame to continue to ask for payment. His servants live well, but hate him. The slums are filled with his cast-off maids and their bastard children. He loves only whom he fears, and none of them pay either." The man was very drunk, Anna thought, to be so forthright. "I will give you an advance, and more than you ask, if the dress is what I require, and in time. Make me look like any of the best of them." He slowly smiled. "No."
Her eyes narrowed.
"You will not?"
"Not entirely," he said, warming to his subject. "If I dress you like them, you will appear ridiculous in borrowed plumes. The trick is not to ape your betters, nor to appear purely countrified or provincial, but exotic. So well informed that you acknowledge fashion and yet make it your own. Embrace that difference and you will disarm them entirely with your novelty. Make them love you for it." Anna didn't understand completely, but looking around the beautiful shop, decided to trust him. She nodded. "If you are sure you can accomplish this..." She pulled out her purse and set coins one by one on the counter. He eyed the gold and was instantly her accomplice. "I will make you fascinating." Having agreed on a pattern, materials, date, and a price, Anna turned to leave. She stopped, again captivated by the elegant doll, which was composed, mute, and immobile, and yet dictated fashion. Anna found this power admirable. Anna now had 1 week, and only one chance to observe Earle. Anything else she gave Brown would be hearsay, which she knew would disappoint him. That she dared not do. In her room, she weighed that disappointment against the last of Brown's money and a fast ship for Holland. Even if she managed to slip away from Seaver, who no longer bothered to conceal his presence much, she knew she would never be able to forsake the Queen's Arms. It was either success or a noose. The evening of the party, Anna dressed, then met Mrs. Western. She sat up at the sight of Anna, transformed by the tailor, as did Mr. Upton.
Mrs. Weston marked this attention jealously as she made the introductions. "I have a carriage, and would be delighted to show you the metropolis on our way," Mr. Upton offered. Anna watched Mrs. Weston bridle as she accepted. Night revealed more than daylight. Torchlight illuminated the Ranelagh Rotunda and the music and diversions there, but Anna also noted the whores and beggars outside. She saw carriages manned by liveried footmen lined up outside Bedlam as their masters viewed the cells, seeking spectacle in the desperate inmates. Mr. Upton, thinking further to impress Anna, pointed out Coram's Foundling Hospital. "It is not 5 years old, built by subscription by our most fashionable ladies, great men, and not a few lords. Children may be left there who might otherwise starve in the street." Anna recalled the tailor's talk of Earl's bastards. Better they might save themselves the expense, and everyone else a great deal of trouble if the great men and lords would only keep their breeches close in the first place, she said without thinking. Mrs. Weston hooted at Anna's audacity. Mr. Upton's jaw dropped. Anna had the sense to make a jest of it. Such is the case in Boston, anyway. Then Anna saw Earl's home, a veritable palace of new sandstone with its own small park, all enclosed by iron fencing. Mrs. Weston took Anna aside. "While Mr. Earl can be very agreeable, he's keenly aware of rank. You could be the Princess Royal of all the savage Americas, and it would mean nothing to him." Anna forced herself to nod. "I mean, I would not recommend the same familiarity with him as you showed Mr. Upton in the carriage." Anna nodded again, but by now her eyes were dazzled. Inside, Earl's house was ablaze with candles, reflecting against gilt and mirrors. She felt dwarfed by what she saw. 20-foot ceilings painted with classical scenes, walls covered with hand-painted Chinese paper and plaster ornaments. The guests were dressed in shining silks and velvets and shone from head to toe. The ladies' coiffures were bedecked with jewels. The gentlemen were resplendent in gold and silver embroidery and braid. And even their well-heeled shoes had silver buckles. There was carved furniture and rugs on marble floors of a sumptuous Anna could scarcely believe. If London had begun to show her its rough edges, this was a world beyond that. Anna groped for the language to describe it, but had none. All she knew was that compared to this masterpiece, Mr. Brown's brick house was in an elegant barn. What had seemed so rare and lovely to her was now quaint and ungainly, contrived by rustics. She could not bear to think of the Queen's Arms, its low-beam ceilings, and her pride in its two good upholstered chairs. And yet, she recalled the tailor's advice. Anna did not try to appear other than she was. She was unfamiliar, so she evinced a quiet air of mystery, and spun that into allure. She acknowledged Mr. Earl politely when introduced, but did not seek further conversation. She made herself agreeable to Mr. Upton and his friends, who had not the least objection, and when she saw herself in one of the mirrors, she didn't recognize the fairy-like creature she'd become. Her turquoise silk stood out against a sea of demure cream satin. An ornament of tiny feathers, an emblem of the Americas, in twinkling French paste adorned her little lace cap, matching the needlework on her stomacher. The side hoops in her skirts were narrow, permitting easier, more graceful movement, and allowing gentlemen nearer. If other ladies had gowns embroidered with flowers, Anna was herself a flower. Mrs. Weston was unhappy with Mr. Upton's attentions to Anna. "This is Mrs. Hoyt's first time in London. She's been viewing the city," she said loudly, near Earl. Earl's annoyance was tempered by his curiosity about Anna. He was not used to such disinterest from a lady. He took Mrs. Weston's cue and turned to Anna. "You have not been in London very long?" "Scarcely a month," she said. "Let me show you everything the city has to offer." What a very friendly gesture. Mr. Upton has already been kind enough to do just that this evening. She bestowed a smile on Mr. Upton and was gratified by the displeasure she saw in Earl. He said, "Mr. Upton should spend his time with Mrs. Weston. She has so little time away from her cows and he from his wife. That is what they share in common, a familiarity with the barnyard." Mr. Upton, overhearing this, took Mrs. Weston's arm and retreated. Anna watched Earl casually discard a man's livelihood and a woman's esteem while their friends laughed. "They make fun of Mrs. Weston, who's done nothing they do not do," she thought. "They make the rules, but even if you follow them, you cannot survive their game." "She's as common as muck," Earl announced, "and he's become tedious. I won't invite him again." His valet said quietly, "But you're backing his venture to the..." Earl frowned. "Enough, Brady. There's always someone else. But, Brady, who are you to judge your betters? You've racked up massive gambling debts and failed to pay them." He attempted to kick Brady, who stepped away. The other gentlemen and ladies exchanged glances of repressed amusement. Anna understood that Earl's rages were also a diversion. She said, "But rumor has it you do not pay your tailor, Mr. Earl, or your wine merchant, or your butcher, or your cabinet maker, or your..." This was met by universal laughter. "None of them pay," she recalled. Earl waved a dismissive hand. "I pay the wretches every quarter. Perhaps not as much as they'd like." More laughter followed. Earl said, "You are very bold." Anna tried to take it as a compliment and dipped a curtsy. "What is that room over there, I wonder?" "Let me show you," Earl said. Anna was aware of the eyes on her as she left with Earl. No sooner had the door closed behind them than Earl took her hand. Anna stepped back. "Mr. Earle, I would like to address a certain matter." He sighed. "You're not going to bore me with business, I hope. You're far too pretty." "Business of benefit to us both, I hope." Anna could already see his interest fading and decided that her boldness had paid off once already. "I was sent to spy upon you." "Oh, yes." He was intrigued now. "Mr. Oliver Brown of Boston has no love for you. He sent me to find out your weaknesses."
Earl's face hardened at the mention of Brown.
"And what shall you tell him?"
"You have a weakness for fine things." She gestured to the room.
"You are vulnerable about the heart with regards to my sex. Word in the coffee houses is you have too many connections in the city and in Westminster, in all the world's ports, to be taken unawares. A man with information and the stomach to use it."
She took a deep breath and offered the last tidbit of information from the invaluable Mr. Nicholas.
"Item, your valet, who owes so many debts, was once your partner."
"You are quick, Mrs. Hoyt."
When Earl's face went bland, Anna knew she'd calculated correctly. He asked, "How have you found London?"
"Very much to my liking. Were it not for my obligations at home, I should be quite happy here."
"Of course, moving from a backwater to the beating heart of the world. What if I were to give you a full and complete list of my weaknesses, which you would convey back to Mr. Brown? Perhaps he would be so pleased he would send you again. A lady like you could be of use to me."
Anna sighed now. "I should find it hard to live without the means of my income at home, which is contingent upon me being there."
"You run some kind of shop or public house, you mean? A rum barrel and a hut in the wilderness." He watched her, and when she did not respond, shook his head.
"Never worry, Mrs. Hoyt. I would assist you in your new life. You would know my generosity and my favor. Think on that.
We shall meet later to discuss the particulars. Brady." His valet appeared, and Earl whispered to him. Brady left only to return with a purse, which Earl handed to Anna. "A token of what you may expect, should you decide to stay." She bowed her head, concealing her triumph. Business done, he led her to his coach. She extended her hand, and he kissed it. "Good night, Mrs. Hoyt."
"Thank you, Mr. Earle. I hope we shall meet again soon."
She smiled brilliantly. He nodded thoughtfully, and the coachman clucked to the horses. Anna clutched the upholstery as the carriage rocked and bounced across the cobbled roads. At first she could feel nothing, then a throbbing seized her head, numbing it to any other sensation. Her ears rang and her nose ached as if she'd been punched. After an eternity, the coach stopped outside her inn. She nodded to the driver, directed the sleepy boy to send hot punch to her room, then climbed the stairs, holding her skirts carefully. Once inside her room, Anna was ill, her insides griping with panic. When her drink arrived, she forced composure upon herself, and that, with the hot rum, helped. She drank deeply, burning her tongue, thinking of Brown and Earl. The rich have no grace save to the extent they may indulge their depravities. They create manners and laws to enslave those beneath them, with no consequence. They are nothing but silver tin, but because of a trick of birth, I, despite my excellent clothes and modest behavior, am nothing to them. One last time, Anna counted the money left from Brown's investment, adding Earl's purse to it. She could leave with Brown's ship, hoping Earl would not follow. She could betray Brown, praying Earl's protection would be enough. Or she could flee them both, forsaking the Queen's arms and live comfortably out of reach of anyone who might ask about Hook Miller. A comfortable life was no longer enough, its perceived safety too tenuous. She understood she must constantly improve herself, or she would never survive her dealings with men like Brown and Earl. She opened her Bible, reading in the second book of the Kings. After a few moments, she decided. She washed her face and changed into a simple silk robe, charming in its déshabille. She slipped her small, very sharp clasp knife into her pocket, then checked her looking glass. She whispered to her reflection, "I abjure their power over me. I renounce the illusion of their superiority. I refuse to submit to their order, which demands I trade my survival for their aggrandizement. My will," she told her glass, "or none at all." She had the boy find her a carriage, and just before she arrived back at Earl's house, she reconsidered her intentions. Then she pulled up the hood of her cloak, opened the door, and stepped into the dirty snow. Her thin slippers soaked through, but she never felt the cold outside for the cold within. She knocked softly. The door opened, and she was gathered inside, whiskey breath and slurred words as hands wandered over her fair hair. "Every man exactly the same," she thought. "My beautiful conspirator," he said. "Welcome." She could have borne it better if he hadn't spoke. Anna gathered her courage, raised her hand. She undid the knot at her throat, turned her head away, and thought of the dressmaker's doll as she felt the silk slip from her shoulder. Seated in his parlor several days later, "Mistress Hoyt, Anna," Earl said, "it's been too long since our last meeting." Anna found it in herself to blush. "As you ask, I've sent the rest of my servants away, and Brady can be trusted to keep your secrets." He signaled to Brady, who poured two glasses of wine. Anna lowered her eyes as she accepted one. Earl dismissed his valet. "What have you decided? I'm not one to stand and wait." "Thank you, sir," she gathered herself. "I cannot accept your offer." "No, you've made a bad mistake." He stood and rang a small bell. "And you've only made a fool of me not to answer so before. I should take great care on your way home. The streets can be treacherous." Earl grunted and clutched at his back as if with cramp. He winced, lunged forward to his knees, as Mr. Nicholas Brady pulled back his master's hair and plunged his dagger in again. The blood sprayed in an arc. Anna watched, transfixed, as it flowed down the hand-painted wallpaper and the marble mantel, running vivid against the pale yellows and whites. The Chinese rug, a veritable flower garden, was forever marred as blood soaked into its fibers. Without a word, Anna stepped back from the spreading stain. Her slippers were new and silk-embroidered. It would be too great a shame for them to share the fate of the rug. A fortune in that room lost with just a few ounces of blood. When Nicholas Brady raised his hand again, Anna broke from a trance. "Enough, Nicholas. You've written the letter?" "Dated 2 days ago. No one has seen me since. The rest of the household has already left, and they believe me away on another errand." "And the money you owed him?" She nodded to the dead man on the floor. Brady scowled, his gray eyes clouded. "Surely he has no use for it now." Anna tried not to show her annoyance. "If you wish it believed you discharged your debt and left 2 days ago, you'll leave that money with the letter." Brady looked away first and pulled a large portion of the money Earl had given Anna from his pocket. "You are right." She watched him leave it in a desk drawer. When he came back, he held out his hand. "The rest of our money?" "Our money." She handed him a bag of Brown's gold, transmuted from the last letter of credit. "We must hurry." He pulled her close. "We're alone." "Then let us make the most of that, then." She allowed him to kiss her, but she stared, entranced by the blood on the wall. She shrugged out of his embrace. "I will meet you at the Antelope in Plymouth in a week." "And then the world is ours." She nodded. "It is a long way between us and safety. Do not fail to follow every step of our plan." He kissed her hands, and she pulled away. Time was slipping by. Anna had already packed her trunks and left the West End Inn. After considering how much she'd already spent and how much she must hold in reserve for her journey, she went to the tailor to pay her balance and make one last purchase. Aghast at her spendthrift use of money and time, she hurried back to the Southwark room and barred her door. 2 days before she must leave, she longed for home. She crept onto the bed and pulled her feet tight under her, striving for calm, creating distance between her and the hateful city. A knock woke her the next morning. She uncurled painfully, her heart beating loud in her breast. "Leave me be!" "It's your brother. Come with urgent news from home, madam," the girl called. Her brothers were in the ground next to her parents on Copse Hill. Brady. She cursed the love-struck fool for ignoring her instructions. "A moment," she said, arranging herself. She clutched her Bible close to her. "Come." It was not Brady. It was Adam Seaver. "Brother," she said, rising, "what news?" The maid, satisfied, closed the door behind her. "You've done Mr. Brown a great service," he said. "News is, Earl is dead. His brother, weak as he is in the Commons and is more partial to Brown now Edward is dead." "I never touched Mr. Earl, Mr. Seaver." "Mr. Brown would never ask you to do such a thing, Mrs. Hoyt." It was a gentle reproof. "Earl was struck down by a vengeful servant, I understand. Mr. Brown asked nothing. I did nothing." Seaver sat back. "And yet all worked out perfectly well. What an admirable situation for us all, Mrs. Hoyt." She bowed her head, praying she'd chosen correctly. "I'm sure you've expended all the money you were given to effect so much with so little effort. Brown would not have it said he is ungrateful." "I am happy to bring Mr. Brown such good news." "You will be rewarded for it." He handed her a piece of crisp white paper, a letter of credit against Mr. Brown for a sum of money so great she grew dizzy. Anna smiled, a little numbly, ran her thumb over the black ink. Both Earl and Brown were gross monsters, she thought. But she needed one of them, and Brown at least paid his debts. She recalled the instructions in the Book of the Kings, "Pay thy debt and live." He rose. "You are ready to depart?" She nodded. "I wish I were home now." "I have a carriage. Gather your things." Seaver paused at the door, surveying her. "That dress suits you admirably. It is entirely disarming." "We shall all be very good friends, shall we not, Mrs. Hoyt?" "I hope so, Mr. Seaver." Anna waited until the door closed and she heard his footsteps fade. She opened her trunk and saw her last purchase, the tailor's golden-haired model, frozen in miniature perfection of carriage and dress. She hid the paper under the mannequin's dress and leaned over to whisper, "No need to tell Adam Seaver, Dolly. Nothing I did was for Mr. Brown."
Disarming is copyrighted by Dana Cameron. Music for this podcast is derived from Arcangelo Corelli's Concerti Grossi Opus 6, performed by the Advent Chamber Orchestra and obtained through Wikimedia Commons. Mixing for this podcast was done by Jackie Sherbaugh. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.themysteryplace.com/eqmm.